The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Well, it is good to be back with you, and nothing like a humble claim. The greatest mystery of spirituality clarified in the next 20 minutes. What we are doing over the next few weeks, as was mentioned, we are going to look at what Jesus has to say in perhaps the most profound bit of Jesus' teaching. It's the longest single part of Jesus' teaching in any of the four biographies of Jesus, John 13, 14, 15 and 16. There's a number of questions, because as we're going to see, one of the things Jesus does when you start listening to him, when you really start listening, is he confuses you, but in the way that all good teachers do. But so we're going to try and see what Jesus has to say about this question of spirituality. But spirituality is itself a kind of a perplexing area to dive into, because it's a bit mysterious what the word means. Nonetheless, lots of people use the word. In fact, I want to introduce you to a new word for some, or it's not quite a word, it's a set of letters, and it's in both Australia and America, in census work, this has become a new and growing group in our community, and it's NRBS. Anyone heard this, know what this stands for? It's a shorthand thing that sort of social scientists use for this position, where people want to say, I'm not religious, that's the NR, and the BS part is, but I'm spiritual. And I imagine some of us here in this room might think, I'm not religious, but I'm spiritual. I've got a number of my friends that I've known for decades who would put themselves in that position exactly. But what do they mean by that? What is it? So we're really dealing here firstly with the question of the mystery of definitions. What does the word spirituality mean? And in many ways it's one of the vaguest words in our language. A bit like music. You know, my parents used to say to me when I listened to some of the world's classic music by the Rolling Stones, turn that off, that's not music. Now, I have no idea what they thought music was, but that certainly was music. And one of the problems with things like spirituality is it's a bit like that. What one man says is spirituality, other people say is complete rubbish or dangerous. So we need to look at what we think this word means. What is spirituality? And I want to suggest it by way of two contrasts. One I've already mentioned, let's see if we can get this working. Go the technology. In terms of spirituality, this guy in our community represents spirituality. Not so much religion, but spirituality. In contrast to perhaps this guy, Benedict VI, or JP II, whatever, the Pope. The Pope represents in our community, whether rightly or wrongly, religion. Dogmatic, repressive, powerful. Negative. Everything is fixed. There's no inquiry. Just sit down, shut up. Here's what you should believe. I don't care whether it's true or not. Believe it, because we're powerful. Whereas the Dalai Lama in our community represents freedom, you know, the ability to laugh. It's basically a feel-good experience. And of course, if you know anything about what the Dalai Lama believes, in so many ways, particularly in questions of sexuality, he is much sterner and stricter than JP2 or Benedict VI. But we don't want to confuse ourselves in Australia with the facts of the situation. But generally speaking, spirituality is free, life-affirming. You can pretty much make of it what you wish. So it's in contrast to religion. It's also in contrast to materialism. By materialism, I mean that view of the universe that says that everything, all that there is material. It's stuff. It's energy. If we can't measure it yet with science, we will one day. Everything is explainable in terms of the laws of science as it grows and as it expands. And we see this perhaps if you've watched that, what is it, although I think morally questionable at times, I think Friends is one of the better written TV programs I've ever watched, that in Fawlty Towers. Hard to go past those in terms of the quality of the writing. But Phoebe represents spirituality. She's flaky, but she believes in, well, who knows what she believes in. One day she's cleaning your aura, picking splinters out of it. The next day she's talking about reincarnation and the cat is her grandmother and all sorts of things. She's got a new spirituality just about, you know, every season. But that's okay, because that's what you can be like with spirituality. It's a quest. It's free, it's moving. In contrast to her is, of course, Dr. Ross Geller, who is the materialist. He is the scientist. He endures Fee because they're friends' nonsense, but occasionally they'll have a little clash and a little joke about it. But himself, even Ross Geller, gets a little spiritually when for a period he's going around saying namaste to people. Because it's the quest for something that's sort of sacred, something that's a little deeper than just neurons and thoughts and hard evidence. And spirituality is that quest to move into that area, something a little deeper, something a little richer, something a little bit sort of sustaining of the human heart and emotions. It's often a journey inward to discover your inner, truest self. Sometimes it seems to fall into extreme narcissism, where the self is equated with God. For some, though, it's a journey outward. It's a journey to explore those other beings in the universe that are not physical. God, gods, angels, those sorts of things. And it's got some sense of cosmic connectedness. It's a difficult word to define, but I hope you've got a sense of what we're going here in the question of the mystery of definition. So spirituality is that journey into this unseen realm of things that are deeper, where we'll find things like peace and quests like that. Well, on that sort of definition, Christianity is a form of spirituality. It's a formalized form of spirituality. I guess the big river is spirituality and religion is part of it. Some would suggest that religion is like where the river has been frozen and it's dead and lifeless, but interesting and has its place. But undoubtedly, Jesus would be seen, if you go to the Body, Mind, Spirit Festival and some of these great sort of spirituality events, Jesus is seen in all sorts of things as one of the great spiritual masters, much to teach us, all this sort of stuff. And of course, I, as a Christian, came to that persuasion 30 years ago that he is the master of masters. But looking at this question of epistemology, which is just a pretentious way, I guess it's good to learn big words. Epistemology is one of the three or four great branches of philosophy, and it's the study of knowledge. It's a very important study, and we all are engaged in various epistemological systems, and it's how do you know something? And how do you know that you know something? And is when you say you know something, is it a valid way of talking about knowledge in that area? And it's a very important area. And when it comes to this question of spirituality, how do we know what's really true about the spiritual? Because if you get a whole lot of people who are spiritual together and sit them in a room, they will in the end say a series of things with great conviction that are clearly mutually contradictory if there's any logical reason left in the system. Although some people will actually say, in the area of the material, you can work on yes, no, true, false, evidence, but in the area of the spiritual, kiss your brain goodbye, baby. And the way you work out if something is true is by your feelings. Although that is, of course, a dogma, isn't it? People, one of the things I notice about people who are into spirituality and despise religion is they are remarkably dogmatic. But it's an unconscious dogma. So there is a dogma that undergirds a lot of spirituality that says the way you know something is really true and ultimate is if you feel it's true. That's based on the dogma that says that the great instrument for discovering truth and reality is your feelings. A little reflection on that is kind of scary. In fact, a little reflection on a lot of our lives will show that we've often been absolutely certain that something or someone is true and then move on to discover, gee, what on earth was I thinking to think that this person was true or this system was true? I've had a number of friends who spent substantial parts of their lives in various spiritual quests and organisations that they now, to their credit, with honesty say, it was a total waste of time. Now, some people don't get out that light. Some people get involved in various spiritual quests that actually damages them permanently psychologically. Some people get damaged sexually in various spiritual quests. Some people get damaged terribly financially. So how do you work out that the spiritual thing that you're engaged in is real and true and not just short-term tasty, but long-term good for us? And here I'm going to suggest that Jesus Christ does stand quite unique. He really does ask and give a reason why you should trust him. And the reason is found, as you heard read, when John makes a statement about Jesus, which Jesus often makes about himself. So in John 8 and John 3, Jesus makes this sort of statement, but here it's recorded about Jesus. John chapter 13, the passage is typed out there for you from the biography written by John. Verse 3. Jesus knew. So he's going to tell us what Jesus knew for a fact. Jesus knew that the Father had put all things under his feet. Ooh, that's worth pondering a second, isn't it? Do you know that God has put all things under your feet? Do you know what it means in the Jewish way of thinking to put something under your feet? It means you have rule and authority and power over them. It's the picture of a king who has things under his feet. You know, I don't have much that's under my feet, frankly. But Jesus knew that God had put all things under his feet. A tad more than a prophet, I would have thought. It's a bit like when Jesus says at the very end of Matthew 28, all authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. It's the reason why people who listen to Jesus either despise him as a madman or a blasphemer or worship him. That is an unparalleled statement in the world of spirituality and religious claims. But Jesus knew the Father had put all things under his power, that he had come from God and was returning to God. This is the key thing. I don't know if you know how often in John's Gospel Jesus contrasts himself with others, with good religious, spiritual people of his day. He says things in John 8, you are from the earth, I am from above. He says, I've come from the Father. That's where. So Jesus' view is that when you started your life, you came from the earth. No, that's a good place to come from. It's a good address. Your mum and dad gave birth, you know, they did some stuff and out you came. And you're from the earth. That's your home. That's your home suburb. I'm from Sydney, born in King's Cross and proud of it. Quite an expensive little hospital in King's Cross, but it sounds really tough to say I was born in King's Cross. But we're from the earth. Jesus says, nah, not me. I'm from the Father. He's come from the Father. So when Jesus turns up on the earth, this is where he's come on a journey. It's a bit like, this may surprise you, I existed before I came into this building. Thank goodness. I'm from outside. I'm just passing through this building and hope to get out alive. Right? So, but if you, on the other hand, came out of the ground of Chapter House, you're some sort of troglodyte that was born and have lived all your life in this musty old building, gorgeous as it is for those who like this sort of building. But I come in as a visitor. I know what's outside. Not because I've heard some noise and I'm guessing. I've been out there. I bring you expert evidence. I'm qualified to speak about what's outside. So all the troglodytes who were born and bred in Chapter House, they can now discover the truth. This is what Jesus says of himself. Again, you either have to look at him and think, is there any good reason to believe this outrageous claim that he's come from God direct? Not claiming to have sat under a tree and received some enlightenment or gone to a mountain and heard a voice that he thinks might be an angel, but actually saying, I actually came direct from the presence of God. Let me tell you what I've seen firsthand. So Jesus' claim is that he is the qualified person. He can speak with authority and clarity about the spiritual world. That's why many people give up their own personal opinions. I remember when I became a Christian, I had a number of things that I was convinced of, having moved from being an atheist to then believing in God, but not at all sure what God was like. I had some things I was absolutely certain on. And one of them was, I was absolutely certain on reincarnation. Now, why did I abandon my belief in reincarnation? Because an honest, straightforward reading of Jesus shows he does not believe in it. But I had had experiences. I had read books by a Tibetan monk, who I understand was actually an Irish bus driver, but who can tell when you read a book? Lobsang Rampa claimed to be a Tibetan monk with all sorts of wow experiences, completely unauthenticated, but actually apparently he was a very good bus driver in Dublin, I think. But who can tell when you just pick up a book and don't bother to check it out? But I have to choose between what I believed and what, frankly, I liked, the idea of reincarnation. It avoids the horror of judgment, right? Of that sort of judgment. But Jesus didn't. So in the spiritual, as when I became a Christian, I bowed to his expertise and have found him to be consistently qualified. That's why we're looking at John 13, 14, 15 and 16. Because this is where Jesus will lead us into this way. And he does it in a most peculiar way, but a very Jesus way, which is always unexpected. He does something that is outright weird. It's weird if you think about it happening today, and just sort of, if we just take it out of Bible wonderland and actually imagine it happening. But it's even weirder in Jesus' own day. And it's bizarre, and he behaves badly, and his friends try to correct him, as we'll see. And it's when Jesus gets up. So his brain, we're told in verse 3, he knew the Father had put all things under his power. He'd come from God and was returning to God. So his mind is full of a sense of his own dignity and greatness. So he's not dealing with sort of some low self-esteem, oh, I'm ever so terribly poor. He's got a high sense of it. What does he do? So, verse 4, he got up from the meal, took off his outer clothing, wrapped a towel around his waist. So basically he strips down to his underwear, because they only had two layers of clothing if you're in Palestine. So he strips down to his decent underwear, wraps a towel around his waist, and after that he poured water into a basin and began to wash his disciples' feet. That is, he crouches down at the feet of his disciples and begins to wash them. Presumably this is done in stunned silence until he comes to Simon Peter in verse 6. He came to Simon Peter, who finally speaks and says, Lord, are you my feet going to wash? That's how it's set out in the original. Are you my feet going to wash? Jesus says, Peter, you do not realize now what I'm doing, but later on you will understand. He says, Peter, I know this seems a little weird. You don't understand it now, but you will. Just be a little patient. And Peter's a disciple. That is, he's a learner. He's a pupil of Jesus. He's followed Jesus for 3 years. He's left his income. He's left his wife behind. He's left his mother-in-law behind. This guy's a fully paid-up, serious Christian. So what does he say to Jesus when Jesus says, be patient? No! Verse 8, no! Peter said, you're never going to wash my feet. I don't know about these other clowns, what they thought they were doing, letting you get down on your hands and knees before their feet and wash their feet. You are never washing my feet. That ain't going to happen. This is wrong, wrong, wrong. Now, we know a lot about Jewish culture back then because the Jews, then as now, were a writing people. And we got lots of stuff about this business of foot washing, because it was an important part of going to dinner parties, which this was, the Last Supper. Because basically you walk to places, unless you were very, very rich and had a chariot or a donkey or something like that. And the problem is the footpaths were not like our footpaths, which you might not think are as clean as Singapore's footpaths, but are pretty flipping clean compared to the footpaths in Jerusalem, which were made of mud. And they were also used by horses, donkeys and camels. And the problem with horses, donkeys and camels, no matter how well trained is, they don't use toilets. Well, that's not true. The whole world is a toilet. They just stand and deliver whenever they feel the need to. So the footpath that you walked on, made of dirt and mud, was also for number ones and number twos, and then it would rain and it would all get mushed up. So you not just had good clean dirt, you had rich. Blech. So because when you turned up at a dinner party, and the boys, we hear this in the Gospels, the boys are sent off to arrange for this last dinner. Jesus knew what was going on. He wanted to have this last time with the boys and talk and instruct them in this critical spirituality stuff. They organised for the basin to be there and the towel, but they forgot to organise a slave, because it was very clear who was allowed to wash whose feet in the Jewish culture, and here's how it worked. It was always the job for the lowliest person in the group. So in a family situation, I'm the youngest of five, I can be asked to be the foot washer, right? The older brother, absolutely not, right? If you owned a slave and he was a Jewish slave, so if a Jew had a sort of indentured labourer slave, you could not ask the Jewish slave to ever wash your feet. If you were in the relationship of a rabbi, a teacher, and you had a group of disciples, a common enough thing in the Jewish world then, the rabbi could never ask the disciples to wash his feet. It was just considered too lowly. If, on the other hand, you had a slave who was not a Jew, because racism is alive and well in every culture, you could make that slave wash your feet. But you couldn't get a fellow Jew to. So it was very clear. And we have no example ever, no hint of this sort of thing happening. When Jesus, the Lord and Master and Teacher, and in fact, as he knows, God, strips down to his underwear and does the job of washing dirty feet that none of the other disciples would do. None of them said, gee, someone should wash the feet. I'll do it. Right? I'm the youngest disciple. I'm the slowest learning disciple. I'm the last boy on the whatever. They weren't going to do it. And to their horror, Jesus does it. And I say we have no example of this ever happening in the Jewish world at all, except with Jesus. And Peter knows it's wrong. Now, what on earth are we to learn from this? This is, I want to suggest to you, Jesus' very clear, sort of, it's an enacted teaching moment. It's a parable acted out in front of them. What's it about? Well, you can learn what it's about by the two bits of dialogue, verses 6 to 11, and then secondly, verses 12 to 17, because it's teaching two very powerful things about real spirituality. If you've got enough humility to listen to Jesus about what matters in the unseen, spiritual, eternal world, the first thing Jesus says is, it's about having a wash. Peter says in verse 8, no, you, my feet, will never wash. Jesus says, unless I wash you, you've got no part with me, no fellowship, no participation. There's no friendship between you and me, Peter, if I don't wash you. Well, Peter is happy to change his mind. Verse 9, then, Lord, not just my feet, but my hands and my head as well. He says, look, nothing matters compared to being in friendship and partnership with you. Wash the whole of me rather than me miss out on friendship with you. Jesus says, those who've had a bath need only to wash their feet. Their whole body is already clean. You are clean, though, not every one of you. For he knew who was going to betray him. Here Jesus does what won't surprise you. He goes from the physical washing to talk about another sort of cleanliness. He's not saying all the 11 had a bath except Judas. He's talking about a different sort of cleansing, a different sort of washing. Now, if you've done any of the study of the alleged great religions of the world, in almost all of them, there are various regular rituals of washing in sacred rivers, before you say your prayers, when you get home from the hectic marketplace, there are forms of washing. It's a sense of, it's an awareness of the fact that there is something about you and me that gets unclean. And we need to be cleansed and set free from our selfish sins, our corruption, the pollution in our hearts. You cannot just stroll into the presence of a pure and good God. There's something wrong with us, and we need washing. Jesus here says to his disciples, you don't need the whole big wash again. It's just, you just need the ongoing forgiveness, the ongoing daily removal of the muck that you pick up day by day by day. And Jesus begins by saying, when it comes to life with me, if I don't wash you, we have no friendship. So to put it in more standard biblical terms, Jesus is simply saying, as he says elsewhere, the basic need that you have, the basic need that I have, the basic need that Mother Teresa had, the basic need that the Dalai Lama has, the basic need of every single human being on the planet is forgiveness. You need washing. It's quite clear according to the Bible that if Jesus doesn't wash you, you will not be acceptable to God, you will not be welcome to God, your prayers will not be heard, you will in the end finish up in hell, according to the teaching of the Bible, according to Jesus. Now, you may know more about the spiritual world than Jesus does. Congratulations. But if you think Jesus has some clue as to what people really need in the unseen, deep spiritual world, Jesus says it starts there. So he says to Peter, if I don't wash you, no friendship. So that's the first thing this shows us. We need to be washed. So the first actual movement spiritually is to listen to Jesus. The second is to actually be passive and to let God do something for you, to you. It's not what you can do for God. This is where Christianity is different to almost everything else. It's saying at the heart of your relationship with God is not what you do for God, what fast you go on, what prayers you pray, what pilgrimages you go on. It's actually about God doing something for you. It's acknowledging your need and your weakness and letting him help, forgiveness. So that's in the first dialogue. The second dialogue, quite briefly, in verses 12 through to 17. When he'd finished washing their feet, he put his clothes back on and returned to his place. Do you understand what I've done for you? He asked them. You call me teacher and Lord. That is, you hold me in this exalted status, which he had, you know, and rightly so, Jesus says. He doesn't say, as I'd say, oh, I'm just an idiot like you. Why would you take me seriously? Jesus says, you call me teacher and Lord. Absolutely right. Now that I, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, have done the unthinkable act of humble service, the thing that no one else was willing to do, but I've done the thing that needed to be done. Now that I, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, I think what Jesus should say is, you also should be willing to wash my feet. Nothing that I ask you to do for me should be considered too degrading, because I've done that for you. But he doesn't. He says, now that I've washed your feet, you should wash one another's feet. Jesus saying, I did the unthinkable. Now that's how you should treat each other. You should humble yourselves and be of service to each other. As Jesus says, you know the mark of greatness, Jesus says in Matthew's Gospel and Luke's Gospel and Mark's Gospel, the mark of greatness, Jesus says, is being willing to be a servant, even a slave for the other. So spiritual activity, we tend to think is going to be about going off to a monastery somewhere, a sacred mountain, and being still and being quiet and speaking gently and wearing long flowing robes or something like that. She says, you want to know the mark of a spiritual person? Right. Active works of service. Doing grotty things that other people should do but nobody will do. Making courageous stands that nobody else will make but you will make. It's the humility to act as a servant for others. But you say, so even, for example, when you go home to your family, if you have the blessing of living with a family, you go home, if you're spiritual, that is, if you're a disciple of Jesus, you'll go home as a slave to your husband, wife, flatmate, children. You will not go home saying, they should make me happy. That's the mentality of the Lord. Well, it's the mentality of a sinful Lord, because the Lord of the universe actually comes and washes feet, actually comes and gets nailed up, actually comes and does the unthinkable. He does the thing we need to have done for us. This is the mark of greatness. This is what a real God, or the real God, is like. Human inventions have a God. If they have a God at all who's big and the creator, they have him distant. And everyone has to, it's all about us serving him. The Bible says, well, actually it's not. It's actually about him serving you. It's him in love meeting your needs. And he becomes the model. So you go back to work, and you might be the boss of the company, but you will have the servant mentality. You will be willing to do whatever needs to be done. You won't throw your weight round, demand to be treated as the Lord and Master. You will be the foot-washing boss. And it works. Jim Collins, in his studies of Good to Great, etc., has shown it works. In fact, they are the best and the most revolutionary bosses that lead companies into great periods of prosperity are the bosses who are the servant leaders. He calls them level 5 leaders. So the mystery of spirituality is we start by being passive and letting him wash us, and then it shows itself in active works of grotty love. You might say, but Ian, you don't know the family that I live with. You don't know the grots that I work with. Well, it's worth noting that when Jesus washes the feet of these guys, what they were like. Who are these 12 guys? Well, 10 of them are going to run away when he gets arrested. Oh, great loyal followers, 3 years well spent with those guys. When he finally needs them, they all rack off and look after themselves. So 10 of them are just cowards. Peter is about to say in the second half of chapter 13, will deny even knowing Jesus once, twice, three times, and one of them is Judas, who betrays him to the enemies. So this is hardly, you know, the best of the best serving the best. This is the best of the best serving rubbish, really, like us. So you might say, but these people don't deserve my service. Neither do these guys, neither do you. See, it's not about working out how should I treat this person by how they've treated me. That's just a form of slavery, isn't it? We actually live in forms of slavery. We actually think, this person has treated me badly. I will treat them, you know. No. You work out how to treat this person by how God treats you. It actually sets you free from the other person's bad behavior and bad manners. So, by way of conclusion, what is the great mystery of spirituality? It seems to be dull. It's being humble. John Chrysostom, this great Christian from the 4th century in Constantinople, said this in debate with some non-Christian philosophers. He said this, the foundation of our philosophy of Christianity is humility, humility, humility. John Calvin, a controversial but great French thinker who did most of his work in Switzerland, about 1100 years after John Chrysostom, says this, the central precept of Christian religion is firstly humility, secondly humility, thirdly humility. It's the humility to say, I am not an expert on the unseen deep world, I will defer to his knowledge as the expert. I am not really as good as some people think I am. I need forgiveness. I will ask Jesus to wash me. And I will not live like the Lord of the manor. I will live as a humble servant, like Jesus did. That is how it works. There's a school just across the harbour bridge called Winona. And they have as their motto, Ut Prosim. I think that's what it is. And it means, in order that I might serve, which goes back to its early Christian origins. There was a young girl who was being interviewed to enter the school in year 11 some years back with her mother. And when she heard, she asked, what does the motto mean? And she heard, Ut Prosim. She said to her mother, I'm not going to a school that thinks I should serve others. So she didn't. She went off to some school that doesn't understand that the purpose of life and greatness is Ut Prosim, in order that we might serve. Well, so there's some time for questions. I will now be quiet. Now, this is a very good question. The question says here, is it not contradictory to say that we should be humble than allow ourselves to be served by God? They raise a good point. I think what is clearly not humble is when you make demands of God, when you treat God, and many people do, they treat God like his servant. Like, you know, so that we say, well, God, I'll believe in you when you do this, this, and this, jump through these hoops. When we, that's not humble. But I think if God comes to you and says, friend, you need forgiveness, and I've come to die for you so you can have it, the only arrogant response to that is to say, actually, I don't need forgiveness, or I can do it. That is arrogant. It is an act of humility when you say, I need help. And this is what we say to God. Now, God may well say, well, tough luck. If you look at the pagan writings of the Greeks, etc., to my knowledge, and I've not read this, but I've listened to a guy who's studied this, and he said he thinks there's only one example in all the Greek literature of the gods making promises to humans. It's always humans promising God. It's always on this basis. God, if you'll do this, then I'll do that. Or if I do this, will you do that? They're trying to get God. They're trying to bind God. What the Bible comes in is quite the exact opposite of a Greek and Roman understanding of the gods. That is, God comes and makes promises to us. And this is the way that God, he comes and says, you need me. I love you. I will serve you. The proud person says, I don't need God. So I think but it's a good question. It can look arrogant to say, I will let God serve me. But we're not demanding that God serve us. We're not setting the conditions. We're letting God tell us, here's your situation. You're sick. I've suffered. You can be washed. Next week, we're going to look at the fact that being confused is a mark that you're actually engaged in real spirituality. So come and be confused together, if you like.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.